In the TV show The Office, paper company manager Michael Scott has prepared some diversity and inclusion exercises for his employees. He's really put a lot of time and effort into his presentation, but just as people start walking into the room, one of his least favorite employees makes a smart-alecky remark.
We're not all going to sit in a circle Indian style, are we?
Get out.
So what started as an opportunity for team building turns into more of a lesson in how not to run an office.
No, this is not a joke, okay? It was offensive and lame, so double offensive. This is an environment of welcoming, and you should just get the hell out of here.
So the Michael Scott character, I would say, is pretty much a universal example of poor management. I mean, there is not some type of workplace or some part of the world where this would be considered like a positive exchange. The good bosses out there are probably listening and thinking, man, that guy doesn't get it. But how much does management vary, really? I'm Gina Kaufman, and this morning's guest suggests that leaders actually behave pretty similarly to one another. And this is based on surveys with 6,500 managers in 14 different countries. Art Jago is a professor of management at the University of Missouri. Art, welcome to KCUR's Central Standard.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell me about the study you conducted.
Well, this was a study that involved a collection of data over several years, many years, of managers in different leadership positions within hundreds of different companies. And I was able, for this particular analysis of the data, to take 100 randomly selected representatives of 14 different countries, 100 in each country, and look at their leadership styles and how they were different from each other or how they were similar. So that was the basic methodology involved in the study.
And so what would you say is your big takeaway from looking at all this data?
Well, the big takeaway is that managers are a whole lot more alike than they are different. Not that the differences are not important. And I've done other studies and published other articles that have focused on differences due to gender, organization type, industry, hierarchical level, managerial function. And there are important differences that managers display. But the differences in all of my research and with my colleagues has always shown that individual differences or idiosyncrasies among managers represent a small portion of the overall variance or overall distribution of behavior that is exhibited.
So wait, what are some of the kinds of things that we don't notice that managers basically have in common? Because I do think, like, as employees, we tend to think that our bosses' styles are very specific.
Yes, and very different from other bosses that we've seen.
Yeah, your friend's boss.
Yeah, exactly. And we've all worked for bosses that are highly autocratic, make decisions themselves, are very authoritarian, and other managers who are very democratic. They encourage their subordinates to speak their mind and speak their opinions and engage them and take into account their views and opinions. And there's a lot of managers in between. And we focus on those differences because those differences are very salient to us. But when you get into the weeds and you look at different managers as they actually behave, there's a whole lot more similarities than there are differences.
Okay, so give me a good example of something that is very consistent across the board.
Resource allocation. If scarce resources have to be allocated in a systematic way, all managers will consult their employees, but not leave those decisions to the employees.
So, all of them? They all do that?
Pretty much they do, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Interestingly, the single decision that we find the most variance in behavior, this is the opposite of the question you asked, but the single situation where we find the greatest differences among managers is how to assign parking spaces.
What?
How to assign parking spaces to executives who are all expecting personal parking spaces.
So all around the world, that is the question that,
There are parts of the world where it's not very consequential, like in Beijing. There are no parking spaces in Beijing. So it's largely an irrelevant question. But here in the U.S., it's very relevant. And here's where we really identify some differences among managers, because about 40% of the managers we've asked, how would you assign these privileged spaces, about 40% say they would do it themselves to avoid that this is what they get paid to make decisions about. They have to bear the brunt of bad feelings. And about 40% of managers we ask do the exact opposite. They leave it to the group to decide among themselves who parks where. And the other 20% are in between somewhere. So there's an example of a situation that produces radically different responses among managers.
Am I naive to think that is a small decision? I mean, I've never been a boss.
That is a very small decision, and that's a very important point you make, Gina. It's a small decision. From an organizational perspective, it's inconsequential. The organization and the manager, for that matter, should not care where people park, as long as people park somewhere and they're happy about it, right? And that's why the managers who are highly participative, that's why they leave those decisions to the employees themselves. Let them decide what's fair.
So, I mean, maybe I'm extrapolating too much, but am I hearing that the variation that exists is not only small, but that it pertains to small decisions?
No, it pertains to big decisions as well. But let me continue the thought regarding the smallness of that decision. It's small to the organization. It's not small to the people affected by the decision. Okay? To them, where people park, where your office is located, whether it's a corner office or not, how close it is to the big boss, office amenities, carpeting, that kind of thing. Very important to people because they're symbols of status and hierarchy. So it is a small, inconsequential decision unless you're affected by that decision. Then it's a big decision.
So, like, you know, at 8:58, it feels like a big decision?
At 8:58?
8:58 a.m. is your...
as you're coming into the parking lot?
Right.
And you have to park across the street and there's 3 feet of snow? Yeah, it's a big decision.
So give me an example of a big decision where you saw some significant variation between managers and how they'd approach this.
Okay, a big decision would be a real decision that we've asked many managers how they would handle, and it's when in a plant located away from headquarters is experiencing problems with new machines that have been introduced into the production line that are not meeting expectations, engineering expectations for forecasted production. And here's a decision that many managers differ on. Some like to delve into the data by themselves and determine what part of the production process is at fault. And other managers will bring their subordinates together and say, okay, we're not going to play the blame game, but we're going to examine what part of the production function here is needs improvement.
It's like a group diagnosis of the problem.
Exactly, bringing all kinds of information to bear in a group setting where productive conflict can exist, and the heart of the matter can be examined. So those are some big differences. But, you know, I want to emphasize that the big differences are overshadowed by the similarities.
This is incredibly counterintuitive. And
it is.
I mean, does that make you second guess what you found? Or do you have an explanation for why our intuition is just wrong?
Well, you're right. It is part of our intuition. It's part of our common sense. And in fact, it's in the textbooks. There's one of the best-selling textbooks in international management makes the claim that 50% of employees' behavior, attitudes and behavior, is determined by cultural differences. And that's poppycock. That's just nonsense.
So cultural differences in, like, work culture or culture like country
to country culture. Country to country culture. And work culture can be important in and of itself, but those textbooks are dealing with country to country culture, and arguing that our cultural differences are the primary motivator of our attitudes and behavior. And that's just not true. They're important motivators. And they're certainly, the consequences of our cultural differences are certainly apparent to us because they're visible, they're salient, they're what we notice. We don't notice our similarities. We don't notice our sameness. We notice our differences.
So you talked about there are 14 different countries where you where you presented different scenarios to managers in different industries. You're saying that people are very similar across the board. There wasn't any cultural outlier. There wasn't one country out of those 14 where things were a little more.
Oh, sure. There are cultural differences, and I don't want to neglect those differences. I just want to put those differences in their proper perspective. So the particular dimension of leader behavior I was interested in was what I alluded to earlier when I was talking about the parking lot problem. Some managers are autocratic, others are participative, right? And that's what I was focusing on. And there are countries that are more participative than others. Interestingly, it's the German-speaking world. Austria, Germany, Switzerland, very participative, both on an informal and a formal basis through participation in worker participation on boards of directors and so forth. Sweden, Norway, Finland are also highly participative. Highly autocratic countries are those that come from the former Soviet Union, Poland, Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic, very, very autocratic, despite the huge economic changes that emerged in 1989 when the Berlin Wall fell. Managerial style changes are slow to make themselves evident. In the middle is the United States. We're right between the extremes of high participative and highly highly autocratic and highly participative. But again, those differences account for, they exist, they're important to recognize, but they only account for about 1% of the differences in behavior.
So I guess what for you, why does this matter?
That's a very, very good question. It matters because we need to see beyond the tunnel vision of our stereotypes and our ethnocentrism. We tend to see stability and consistency in behavior in people when it really doesn't exist. And once we begin to realize that all managers are pretty much alike around the world, at least they're more similar than they are different. Not only all managers but all workers, they want a work setting that provides them with meaningful work and economic security of one type or another. They want to be treated with respect and with dignity. These are not characteristics of one culture and not another. They're widely shared.
I don't know the scope of your analysis of all of these people's answers to your surveys,
but
it seems like you have a lot more differences within these. Just on paper anyway, differences between these 6,500 people than just what country they come from. You would have differences in personality.
That's a very, very important question. If you add all the other differences together, in addition to culture difference, if you add differences due to gender, due to hierarchical level, due to education, the total sum effect of individual differences in governing leadership behavior, leadership style, is about 10%. And the rest.
So people are just 90% similar if they are leaders?
Yeah, well, it's hard. I'm not going to say 90%. Some of it we can't detect. Some of it we can't allocate. But what we can say for sure is that when we try to identify the effects of individual differences or uniqueness, looking at things like education, gender, and so forth, the sum total of that is about 10%.
Man, okay. Well, So you've been studying leadership for a long time.
40 years.
When did you first start thinking about it, just like as a person?
I was in college. I was an engineering student at Northwestern University, and I got to, I was chosen to represent the university at a leadership conference for students. And I went there and I thought, this is terrific.
What was terrific about it? Don't be offended, but it sounds very boring to me.
Oh, no, it was eye-opening. Remember, I was an engineer. I was working with numbers and slide rules and design problems. And this weekend experience opened up a whole new vista for me of interpersonal behavior in organizations and how leaders behave and the consequences of that behavior.
So you thought about it kind of like an engineer, like this is a structure that needs to be organized and designed in a certain way.
Very much so. Very much so. Engineers think in a very particular way, and some call that a stereotype, but I'm an engineer, so I can say that. And I approach this whole problem of management and management styles from that kind of perspective, from that logical perspective.
There's this basic thing where groups of people, you know, like we have to accomplish things together, and generally a big part of that, you know, how we organize ourselves to do that is by putting some people in leadership positions. But if you've looked at all these countries, I'm curious whether there's any model for human behavior that does not involve some people being leaders. Does that exist?
There are experiments in leaderless groups and leaderless organizations. There haven't been incredible success stories without some sort of formal hierarchy. However, there are also experiments and studies with flatter organizations, organizations with fewer hierarchical levels, and those organizations can be very, very successful. Fewer middle-level managers and more involvement and delegation of authority to the very lowest levels in the organization.
You know, you've talked about that you've looked in some way, you've analyzed across industries. And mm-hmm. I am curious about what you see as far as like what works and what doesn't leadership wise from one industry to another. Would an arts office function about the same way as like a military setting?
You've hit on one of my examples that I often use. There are industry differences, and the military is a perfect example. The most autocratic group I've ever worked with was a group of Navy admirals. But that's okay for them. I mean, autocracy works in the military because you wear your authority, you wear your legitimate power on your sleeve, and everyone recognizes it. In other organizations, which have different purposes and different operational needs, a military model is not going to work. So where you need creativity and the involvement and the interaction among people to develop new products, new techniques, you need creative planning of one type or another. The leadership style there has to be very, very different.
Art Jago with us this morning from the University of Missouri in Columbia. Thank you so much for sharing your research.
Thank you, Gina. I enjoyed it.
I'm Gina Kaufman. When we return, local women who are making waves in economics. Stay tuned. We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And in economics, only 30% of PhDs are women. But in the Kansas City area, some of the biggest names in economics are also women. I'm here with UMKC's Stephanie Kelton and KU's Donna Ginther. They've both influenced national politics and ruffled a few feathers with their research and thought. We'll hear what they have to say about being women in economics. But first, let's get into who they are and what they're best known for. Stephanie Kelton, good morning.
Morning.
You are one of the main thinkers behind something called the modern monetary theory. Can you explain what that is in the simplest terms imaginable for a layperson? person like myself?
I can try. So in economics, there are different schools of thought. People may have heard of like the Chicago School of Thought or something like that. So I guess in a way, the modern monetary theory has become a new school of thought in economics. Sometimes it's just referred to by its acronym MMT. And what we've done, I think, it's a body of scholarship that's been assembled over 20 or so years by a handful of economists who are trying to get at the fact that basically we're no longer on a gold standard. And I know that probably shocks people to realize that the discipline is so far behind that it's actually taken a small number of economists to constantly remind people that the modern monetary system doesn't operate the way it did when we were on a gold standard or even before 1973. And this opens up policy space and allows us to do bigger, more ambitious things.
What can we do that's different than we have thought it was, based on what you're saying is some holdover from the gold standard?
Right. So the thinking is basically in, let's say, Washington, D.C., that in order to pay for a new program, whether it's infrastructure or additional money for education or whatever, that you have to, quote, find the money. And you hear politicians say that all the time. Well, where are we going to find the money? Where are we going to find the money? I mean, it conjures up in your mind that they're actually, you know, looking for cash somewhere, that they're looking
for piles.
Yeah, piles of cash. Or if you like, that somehow we've got to go dig up a shiny metal from under the ground and that somehow that will give us the ability to go out and finance an infrastructure program or something like that. And so what we're doing is just reminding people that that's not the way it works, that we have moved off the gold standard. We're no longer working in a world where, yeah, go
but,
ahead.
But does this mean, I mean, that means that we don't have to find money to pay for things we want to do?
It does actually mean that. What it means is that if Congress wants to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure, that they simply have a bill and members of Congress, the House and the Senate, vote. And the vote itself, if it passes, provides the financing. It's the authorization to spend that itself provides the money to pay for the infrastructure. And so we think of, here's the way I think people tend to think about it. They tend to think about money coming into government, and then government has money, and then it can turn around and spend that money on something. And a better way to think about it in the modern era, and we know this because we all work with, you know, debit cards and credit cards, and we're used to computers and digital entries. The better way to think about it really is that the U.S. government is the scorekeeper for the dollar. And the dollars appear and disappear. And when the government spends and it, you know, buys aircraft carriers or something like that, or, you know, airplanes from Boeing, it puts numbers on a balance sheet. The numbers appear, and they appear because the government is spending, right?
When you compare this to how I behave with a debit card, that concerns me a little. But that's because of a phrase just popped into my head that I used to use when I was perhaps not as careful as I should have been about what was coming in and what was going out of that bank account. And it was banking by the force. I just sort of felt whether I could afford something or not. Mm. And I mean, that seems like, in a way, just it's making the personal finance comparison. It does. I mean, I think you can imagine why people have trouble accepting that we can spend as much as we want and that it's not a problem. I mean, it goes against the Shakespearean axiom, spend only as thy purse can buy.
Okay, well, two things. First, I didn't say, I didn't mean to imply that we can spend as much as we want there are no consequences. Okay,
gotcha.
So first thing. And the second is, I also didn't mean to imply that the federal government is like a household or
right.
that, you know, they have a credit card and it's akin to a credit card that you and I have. So there's a fundamental difference between the federal government of the United States of America and a private individual, a household, a business, even a local or a state government has to operate by a completely different set of rules because the federal government is spending its own currency into the rest of the economy. And then it reclaims some of it when it collects taxes from us. What it leaves, so let's say they spend $100 billion into the economy, and over time, $90 billion is recovered through the collection of taxes. What that means is the government has run a deficit of $10 billion, but the piece that people miss is that it's left $10 billion behind somewhere in the economy for someone else, and that becomes the surplus in the rest of the economy. So I know people tend to rail against government deficits. Oh, the government's run a deficit. It's a terrible thing. But they tend to forget the other side of the balance sheet, which is that somebody got a surplus of an equal amount. And that somebody is the rest of us in the non-government part of the economy.
I read an article that called you a deficit owl, which basically means that unlike a budget hawk who would be obsessed with cutting spending or a budget dove who would be willing to get into deficit spending only when the economy is on the skids, you espouse a theory that says what exactly? I mean, what is a deficit owl?
So the way I like to think about budget deficits or surpluses or the budget outcome is that it's impossible to tell in advance whether the budget should be in deficit or surplus or balance, okay? That you have to think of it in the context of the rest of the economy. So when we read a newspaper article that says the government's budget deficit is 3% of GDP or, you know, $450 billion or something, how are we supposed to know if that's a good number or a bad number? The knee-jerk reaction is to think that government must have done something wrong. If it's run a deficit, it's done something wrong. And the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, where I worked for a time, is a Republican. And his name's Mike Enzi. He's out of Wyoming. And he loved to say, you know, this was just the way he always thought about it. He'd say, the budget deficit, the federal government is spending more than it takes in. We run deficits. That's evidence of overspending. And I would say, no. That's not evidence of overspending. We all know what evidence of overspending is. It's inflation. And so when you said earlier, does it mean that we can just spend as much as we want? The answer is no, right? There is a constraint. And the constraint is how many resources do we have? And if we try to spend too much, we're going to push up their prices and have an inflation problem.
So it sounds like you're saying that just the deficit is not how you measure whether we're spending too much.
Yeah, the budget outcome doesn't tell you anything about whether the government is behaving well or whether it's a good number or a bad number. That's the budget itself is not the goal. The goal is, let's say, a full employment economy with low inflation, better equitable distribution of the gains, right, when the economy does well so that more people share in the gains of a growing economy.
So what about, are there concerns that would be related to a large deficit, such as future generations needing to pay for things like that? That's what you hear.
You do hear that. And it's a common refrain. And it's a way that, both parties in some sense are guilty, but maybe one more so than the other with respect to that particular, narrative. We can't spend more because we'll burden the next generation. Well, what they're talking about is, leaving behind more U.S. treasuries, because that's what the national debt is. So a lot of the times people will say the national debt is a burden to future generations. And I'll ask them, do you know what the national debt is? And many people will just say, I don't. Say, okay, well, the national debt is all of the outstanding U.S. government bonds. They're the treasury bonds. But they're the debt of the federal government, but they're assets to all the people who hold them. So in a sense, if you say, if we grow the national debt, it's a burden on future generations, well, what we're leaving future generations are more assets, more treasury bonds, right? Now, how those bonds are distributed is a different question, okay? Not everybody gets to hold them, and they're nice, safe assets, and they pay interest, and they build wealth for people, and they're not equally distributed. It's not as if everybody benefits when the national debt increases. But it is the case that you can't burden...
some people benefit.
Yeah, and you don't burden an entire generation. If we build infrastructure today, if we fund education today, we have a better educated population in the future. We have safer and better infrastructure in the future, and the whole generation improves as a result.
So tell me about your foray into national politics. I mean, you were the chief economic strategist on the Bernie Sanders campaign, and you'd already worked for him, as you kind of mentioned, when he was a ranking member of the Senate Budget Committee. How did that all come about?
I had done some work on an advisory committee. He was looking at the Federal Reserve, and he put together a committee to reform the Fed. And he assembled, I think, 10 or 13 or so economists a number of years ago. And we didn't actually do very much. We got on the phone a few times with the senator and with Chairman then Bernanke at the Fed and had a few conversations. But it wasn't much. But then years later, when he became the ranking member of the Budget Committee, there's a position for a chief economist. And he called me. And that's how it happened.
When Bernie Sanders looked like he maybe had a chance in that Democratic primary, even a chance at the White House, you must have thought there was a chance that your theories would stop being theoretical, that they'd shape the direction of our country's policy, possibly. Was that strange for you?
Well, I don't think I was that optimistic. I did think that it afforded a new opportunity to have a chance at that level, right, to change the thinking. And we did do that to some extent. I would definitely argue that we made strides there. It was for sure exciting. And I think that what really kind of struck me, to be honest, is that when I got to Washington, D.C., I'd never worked on the Hill before, but all of these people started reaching out to me by email and by phone and saying, we've been following your work for a long time. We're so glad you're here. Can we have coffee? Can we talk? And I thought, well, there's like a sleeper cell of this, you know, people who have been interested in this approach for a long time.
Did you get the opposite? Did you get people who are like, I've been following you and...
Well, there were definitely people on the other side of the aisle who knew where I was coming from. And I think it rattled some people, maybe in some other government agencies, that I might have now a platform where I could, you know, shine a light on some real fundamental misunderstandings about the way we talk about some of these big issues. And I think that shook some people a little bit. But
your ideas have not generally been considered mainstream. I mean, I think that's probably fair to say. And when a major political candidate is drawing more and more support, I mean, you talk about a sleeper cell, but what about what is and isn't mainstream in economics? Did it make you question that? I mean, where the mainstream is flowing?
Well, it is fluid. I mean, that's a good word that you use, because macroeconomics is this kind of living, breathing thing that it's, in a way, it's not like other disciplines. There are huge debates over really fundamental things. And did it make me question? I think I'm not really sure how to respond to that. I just think that it was encouraging to know that there was an opportunity to get these ideas out, and that so many people had already had this percolating. And, you know, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's fair. You can't tell me what everyone in the country thinks. Well, Stephanie, hang with me for a minute. Okay. We're going to meet Donna Ginther now. Donna's with us from the KPR studios in Lawrence. Hi, Donna.
Hi.
When did you first become interested in economics?
I became interested in economics when I was in high school. That was in the early 1980s. When the last huge recession hit and the economy was collapsing because Paul Volcker was raising interest rates to double-digit levels.
So,
and the economy was just, you know, teetering on the brink of a worldwide Great Depression.
How did that hit you as a high school student? I mean,
Well, my dad was unemployed for a while. You know, we saw farmers. I grew up on a farm in Wisconsin. We saw farmers' neighbors going out of business. It was really devastating.
The scarcity of resources in general seems to be something that you focus on in your research. Was that shaped by those early experiences?
Well, yeah. Originally, I was very interested in politics, and I worked on Capitol Hill. I was a page in Washington, D.C. when I was in high school. I went back in college and worked on Capitol Hill a couple times. And I realized that all politicians do is argue over the allocation of scarce resources. So understanding economics was the key to understanding, you know, how the world around us actually functioned.
So talk to me about some of what you consider to be your most exciting research.
Well, I'm a very broad sort of research portfolio. I have worked on the economics of science. That's probably the work I'm most well known for. And that's looking at how, you know, federal funding of basic research is allocated. And we showed in 2011 that Black investigators are significantly less likely to receive NIH funding compared to white investigators. We did a follow-up study this past year that showed that if you interact gender and race, it's race that's most salient. Women aren't necessarily disadvantaged, but Black women are disadvantaged at the same rate as Black men. And we're continuing to work on that. In January, we published a paper that looked at the economic value of having a postdoctoral research position. And we showed that if a biomedical scientist spends, you know, 4 years in a postdoc, that they take a long-term earnings hit that lasts for the first 10 to 15 years of their career. And, you know, the only thing a postdoc is good for is getting an academic job, and there aren't many of those around these days.
So you, I mean, you have researched as an economist kind of using, I don't know, like a credo of journalism, which is follow the money. I mean, because you're asking questions about equality and actually inequality, but using money and investment, it sounds like, as an indicator of those things.
Well, you know, a lot of, you know, Stephanie's work is about the macroeconomy. I'm a microeconomist. And so I'm looking at decisions and how money and choices affect outcomes. So I'm looking at what individuals, how individuals make decisions, and money, because I'm an economist, is a metric and a measure. And we look at the influence of money on outcomes, and we look at who gets the money.
You have researched gender equality and gender inequality in the field of economics, right?
Yes.
So that seems relevant to the two people I'm talking to right now. Could you tell me just sort of broadly what your research found, and later we'll get to what your experience tells you?
Well, the situation for women academic economists is not as good for women as it is for women in other disciplines. We have a persistent gap in getting promoted to tenure. Women actually, since the 90s, we have a paper that came out in 2014 that showed that it's only in the economics profession where women's performance has actually gotten worse relative to men. They're publishing fewer papers. The gap of publications is growing. The satisfaction gap of women in academia is the largest in economics and has grown since the 1990s. So something is happening in economics that makes us different than other disciplines.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, we will hear about Donna Ginther and Stephanie Kelton's own experiences at women as women at the top of their field. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we'll pick right up where we left off after this break. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and I'm talking to two pretty big deal economists in our area, Donna Ginther and Stephanie Kelton. Stephanie's at UMKC and Donna's at KU. And we are just getting into the issue of what it's like to be a woman at the top of this field, given that only 30% of PhDs in economics are women. And Donna was just telling us about some of her research into this exact question. And Stephanie, as Donna was telling me that this is one of the academic fields with a really large relative gap between what men and women experience, you were nodding.
Oh, sure. I mean, it's, you know, I know women are very underrepresented in the field. When Donna was talking about the differences, the pace at which women proceed through the ranks of assistant professor to an associate as they get promoted to full professor, far fewer women end up making it all the way to the rank of, you know, full professor, publications and so forth. I mean, this is something that I see, and I see it in the graduate student classes that I teach in terms of the number of females who are enrolled in these courses and so forth. Right now, for the first time I think ever in my 17 years at UMKC, I have a PhD class that I'm teaching, and there are no female students. And it's always unbalanced, but I've never seen it where we don't have any at all in a class. So
that do you get a larger sense that this isn't improving and might actually be going the other direction?
I don't know. See, I'm trying to. This is a one-off, right?
Yeah,
so
right.
It could be an anomaly. I hope it is. We definitely have a good number of female students in the doctoral program and in the master's program and undergraduate and so forth. So there is broader representation. It's not balanced, but I don't know whether there's a change underway in terms of the number of applications that we're getting. We just are getting ready to look at the next big stack of applications for next fall. So I know we're all looking with a careful eye as we think about, you know, accepting students, that we're cognizant of the importance of having a good mix of, you know, students from all over the world and from males and females and so forth.
Do you think that you've ever experienced setbacks, not just in academia, but like in the larger world of economics having to do with being a woman? I mean, you've worked in the political sphere. You've done a lot of different stuff.
I just don't feel like I have. I mean, and probably I have, but I just maybe even haven't noticed it in some ways. I know that I feel very fortunate. I think I've had a lot of opportunities and I've progressed through the ranks, and I just think that, but I think I'm unique in a lot of ways. I don't know why sort of the chips fell the way they did for me, but I feel like I've been fortunate within this profession to have the opportunities that I've had. And I know that it's not the same for all women, but I do feel very lucky.
Donna Ginther, what is your sense of why? Have you done research that would tell you why some of these inequalities exist?
I've done a bit of research. I think one of the things that people don't appreciate and is that in the economics discipline, it's a very sort of, there's a high return on being persistent. And if you get discouraged by being told no when you get a referee report on a journal article, or if you get discouraged by, you know, sort of the experiences of our profession, which can be rather confrontational, you may be less likely to be successful.
So explain to me what you mean by confrontational. How is being particularly like an academic economist a confrontational thing?
Well, when we present our research, every statement you make is open to question. Other disciplines will wait politely till the end of your presentation to ask you questions. But in economics, we jump in, we debate your assumptions, we ask you, is this real or not? And if that makes you uncomfortable, it's gonna be difficult for
so
you as an economist.
Is it your experience with students of different genders that women do experience that differently?
I've had male colleagues who experience that. I've had female colleagues who experience that. It's just a matter of understanding how the culture works. I don't think, you know, when we present our work in seminars, it's ad hominem attacks. I think it's, you know, basically, are your ideas, you know, consistent? Do they make sense to other economists? And, you know, there are different schools of thought, and you can present some work that may not be of the prevailing, you know, conventional wisdom in the profession, and you're going to get a lot more questions than you would if you are sort of towing the mainstream economic line.
Stephanie, is this something that you've experienced?
Well, yeah, I honestly, here's the thing. You would think, and I know what Dawn is talking about, but from my own perspective, from my own experience, I have just had such great experiences because I feel like, you know, I've honed this narrative for so many years that I'm able to go before
of modern monetary theory.
Yeah. Yes. Of explaining how the modern monetary system works and what are the implications of this understanding. And I feel like I've done it so many times because I basically live on the road and do these public speaking things that I go before audiences that are so conservative in their orientation that normally you would think this is like walking into the lion's den. You're going to get eaten alive here. Never mind being a woman doing it, but just the content itself. And I'm telling you, I leave and they're delighted. Everywhere I go, I have huge crowds that come up at the end. Everybody wants to talk more. I mean, one speech leads to six more invitations, and it just goes on and on. So that's why I say I feel so lucky that I've just been treated very well, even though I'm walking in with and delivering a message that is well outside the conventional wisdom about how to think about some of these issues.
Donna, what do you make of what Stephanie's saying?
Well, I think we're speaking of different contexts. Mm-hmm. If you go to a university that's full of academic economists, you experience one type of reception. If you go to give a speech about your research to a general audience, mm-hmm. you'll experience another type of reception to your work. I think what happens in the economics profession for junior economists is that, it's hard to get published. Our publication lags are longer than in any other discipline. A young woman will come to a department and maybe be only one or two women. And you can feel isolated, and that may lead women to choose another sector of the economy to work in. Economics is fortunate in that you can work in the private sector, you can work for the government, and you can work for academia.
You've worked for the Federal Reserve, and I'm curious how your experience there differed from your experience in academia.
Working at the Fed was really interesting. I did so after undergrad. I was a research assistant at the board, and then I was at the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta during the Great Moderation, where there wasn't a lot of policy things being done. Everything was humming along smoothly.
The Great Moderation, what are you referring to?
The time between 1991 and 2007, when the economy would have recessions, but they would be very shallow. There would be a jobless recovery, but not lots of people were losing jobs.
Gotcha.
There wasn't a complete financial collapse between the late 90s.
I remember
the early
that.
90s. Yes, it was kind of boring from a monetary policy perspective because things were pretty quiet.
And so, gender wise, though, was the Fed a welcoming, good place for a woman to work?
When I was first doing the research, I was on women in the economics profession. I was at the Fed. And I looked at the number of women in management ranks in the Fed and compared that to the number of women with tenure in academia. And the Fed was actually doing better than academia in terms of having more women involved in upper management. So I thought of the Fed as being a welcoming place to women.
What do you make of this notion? You talked about being one of only one or two women in a department of economics. What do you make of that level of interest, which sounds pretty low?
Well, I am discouraged by the number of undergraduate women who pursue economics. I think that the way that we teach economics is a little dry and arcane, typically. And
what does that have to do with gender? Don't men
get
bored
too? Well, part of what we see, economics rests on a foundation of mathematics. Young girls, even the math gap for young girls is narrowed relative to young boys, but it's still there. And either they don't like the math or they have other preferences and tend not to major in economics. In fact, Claudia Golden at Harvard University is running an experiment where PhD granting institutions are a treatment or a control group, and the treatment group are trying different ways to increase the number of young women who are majoring in economics. And the control group, University of Kansas is in a control group. We're not really taking any sort of intentional approach to increasing the number of undergraduate majors.
I know we're just on our way out of here. So just quickly, Stephanie, do you feel like when you tell people you're an economist that they respond with surprise? People who don't know you, you're just meeting a stranger.
You know what I'll sometimes do before I tell them I'm an economist? They say, what do you do? And I say, I'm a teacher. And they say, oh, what grade? So they automatically assume, that you must teach K-12 or something. And I say, oh, college. Oh, what do you teach? Economics. And there's usually just a look, I think people tend to be surprised.
Maybe there's something cultural there underpinning some of this. Well, we've got to go, but it's been great talking to you and to hear what you have to say to each other. Donna Ginther with KU's Department of Economics and Stephanie Kelton with UMKC's. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, we will have a Valentine's Day edition of our food show. If you're hoping to prepare a romantic meal at home, we'll have tips and inspiration. And if you're going out, we will help you find not the best food in town, but the best cocktails because, well, it's Valentine's Day. That's tomorrow at 10. And you can listen back to any of our shows at kcur.org/Central Standard. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. Our intern is Caitlin Troutman. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.